Ladies and gentlemen, last week I discussed the branch of philosophy called metaphysics, the study of the fundamental nature of reality. I said that the metaphysical base of objectivism is the recognition of the fact that reality exists independently of man's consciousness, that reality is an objective absolute, that it exists independent of whether any consciousness perceives it or not, that everything which exists possesses identity, meaning that that which is what it is, and that consciousness is the faculty of perceiving that which exists. This evening I will discuss the nature of man's consciousness. First, man's cognitive faculty, and then a brief discussion concerning the nature of the subconscious and the nature of emotions and their relation to reason. When I speak of man's cognitive faculty or of cognition, I refer to the faculty and process of understanding, of grasping, of apprehending the facts of reality, of learning that which is true, in a word, of acquiring knowledge. The branch of philosophy that is concerned with the nature and means of human knowledge is epistemology. Epistemology deals with such questions as, how does man acquire knowledge? What are his means of perceiving reality? By what criteria is he to judge the truth or falsehood of his conclusions? To be conscious, man must possess a means of consciousness. That is to say, he must possess some means of perception and awareness. Consciousness is a faculty, and the faculty cannot be exercised without specific means. A consciousness without means of awareness is a metaphysical and logical contradiction. To be is to be something. Consciousness, like everything else that exists, possesses identity. It is a specific faculty that operates by specific means. Let us now turn to a consideration of that means. The source of all human knowledge is the evidence of reality provided by man's senses. Sensation is the state of awareness produced by a physical stimulus transmitted from sensory receptors along nerve cells to the brain. It is the state of awareness, for instance, which is produced by light waves striking the retina of the eye, or sound waves striking the membranes of the ear. Sensations constitute the mind's first contact with reality. A sensation is the primary material out of which all subsequent knowledge is built. But a sensation as such is not knowledge. It is only the material of future knowledge. Discriminated awareness begins on the level of percepts. Percepts constitute the actual starting point of human knowledge in the sense that percepts are man's first fully aware cognitive contact with reality. What is a percept? Well, borrowing Miss Wren's definition, a percept is a group of sensations automatically retained and integrated by the brain of a living organism. Man's knowledge begins when, at the start of his life, he integrates the evidence of his various senses, sight, touch, sound, etc., into the perception of objects, of entities, of things. Perception begins when he is able to perceive and distinguish entities, chairs, tables, trees, people, and so forth. I have said that percepts constitutes the real starting points of man's conscious perception of reality. Percepts are the given, the self-evident. The knowledge that percepts, in fact, consist of integrated sensations is acquired by man much later. It is a scientific conceptual discovery. Man is not ordinarily, if ever, aware of sensations as such. What he is aware of is the result of the integration of different sensations into perceptions, as we have already seen. For example, when you look at an object in this room, now as an adult, you perceive it instantly and automatically as an object. If you look at a lamp, you perceive it immediately as a lamp. You are not aware of the sensory material, of the separate sensations that your brain had to integrate in order to make you able to perceive this. You would find it extremely difficult and probably impossible to break this percept up into the, or break it down more precisely, into the various separate sensations of which it is composed, the sensations of color, shape, texture, etc. As an adult, you are aware of the fact that you see a lamp, and you know that it is a sense organ, the organ of sight, which makes it possible for you to see. But your eyesight alone does not give you the perception of this lamp. Your eyesight gives you only the visual sensations, which your brain has integrated with other sensations into the percept of a lamp. If you want an example on the adult level of how sensations are integrated into percepts, consider the process by which one becomes familiar with a new piece of music, such as a concerto or a symphony. The number of sensations registered in the brain when you hear the music for the first time or for the 20th time is the same. But observe that in each successive replaying, you hear more and more. On the first hearing, you can discern perhaps only one or two themes or melodies. But gradually you perceive more. You perceive how one melody grows out of another and how the various themes interconnect. This is accomplished by the gradual integration of separate snatches and strands of sound into more complex patterns, so that given the same sensory stimuli, you end up by perceiving subtleties and interrelationships that escaped you in the beginning. The first act of integration performed by a human consciousness, the integration of sensations into percepts, is performed automatically by man's sense organs, nerves, and brain. We can observe that a similar automatic integration is performed by the brains of the higher animals, and that they too are aware of reality by means of percepts. But the next step of awareness is not an automatic process. It is the step that only a human mind can take, the step that leads to the level of awareness proper to the consciousness of man, the conceptual level of awareness. In a basic introductory course such as this, we can only touch upon some of the broad fundamentals involved in that very complex subject which constitutes the epistemology of concept formation and the nature of concepts and abstractions and so forth. The full objectivist statement of the nature of concept formation is to be found in Miss Ram's monograph entitled Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, which originally appeared in a number of installments in The Objectivist and was subsequently published by The Objectivist in booklet form. In my very brief discussion of the subject, which is to follow, I will borrow very heavily from Miss Rand's formulations in this monograph. To begin with, let us begin to clarify the meaning of a concept. A concept, quoting Miss Rand, is a mental integration of two or more concretes, which are isolated according to a specific characteristic and united by a specific definition. Now let us elaborate on the meaning of this formulation. A child, for example, observes that tables have a similar shape, which is different from the shapes of all the other objects around him. He focuses on this distinguishing characteristic. He isolates tables from all the other objects, and he classifies them mentally into one group or class. A little later, he learns to designate this group, this kind of object, by the word table. The mental process required to form a concept is the process of abstraction. To abstract means to take out, to isolate a particular characteristic from all the other characteristics of an object and to consider it separately. In the process of forming concepts, there are two acts which are basic, isolation and integration. Isolation and integration are the essentials of the process of forming concepts. The process consists of observing the similarities and differences among things, of abstracting the similarities as distinguishing characteristics, of isolating similar things from all others, and of integrating them into one group, into one concept. A concept stands for an unlimited number of concretes of a certain kind. For instance, the concept table includes all the tables that now exist, all the tables that ever existed, all the tables that will ever exist. The first concepts a child forms are concepts of entities, such as table, chair, man, etc. He learns subsequently to form concepts of attributes, of actions, of relationships, and so forth. For instance, to form the concept of an attribute such as, let's say, the color green, the child observes such instances of green as, say, green grass, green curtains, a green dress, a green rug. He abstracts the attribute they have in common, namely their color. He isolates that color from all others and integrates it into the concept green. Let us pause for a moment on the meaning of the word attribute. An attribute is an aspect or characteristic of an object which can be isolated and identified conceptually, but which in fact cannot be separated from an object and cannot exist by itself. For instance, you can consider the length, the color, and the weight of an object separately. Length, color, and weight being attributes, of course. But length, color, and weight do not exist by themselves. There are no such separately existing things as length. There are only long objects. There is no such separately existing thing as, say, redness. There are only red objects. Thus, the concept red would be defined, in effect, as a color attribute of objects, not as a thing called redness and existing apart from red objects. Starting from the first level of concepts, which identify perceptually observed concretes, man forms higher levels of concepts which represent wider integrations. For instance, he integrates the concepts table, chair, bookcase, bed into the wider concept furniture by observing the characteristics which they have in common and which distinguish them from all other objects. Then he integrates the concepts furniture, dishes, rugs into the still wider concept, household goods. Then he integrates the concepts household goods, buildings, transportation vehicles, into the still wider concept, man-made utilitarian objects. Or, he integrates the concepts man, cat, dog, bird, into the wider concept, animal. Then he integrates the concepts animal and plant into the still wider concept, organism, or living entity. The process of abstraction and concept formation works in two directions: to unite concrete objects into wider abstractions and into wider, more general classifications, or to break up abstractions or break up concepts or classifications into narrower subdivisions, narrower abstractions, narrower concepts, narrower classifications. For example, you might start by forming the concepts of man, animal, and plant, then unite them into the wider category of organisms, that is, living entities. Or one might start by forming two very wide categories or concepts, living things and inanimate things. Then break up the concept of living things into narrower categories such as man, animal, plant. The process of learning, of expanding one's knowledge, uses both methods constantly. For instance, in the early stages of the science of biology, a scientist may integrate certain living entities into the concept animal. Then he subdivides the concept animal into the subcategories of mammal, bird, fish, reptile, etc. With further knowledge and observation, each of these subcategories is divided into many, many more subcategories, which in turn can be subdivided and so on. To quote from a lecture given by Ms. Rand at NBI on the nature of concept formation, quote, "Concepts pertaining to man's consciousness, such as thought, memory, emotion, etc., are derived from the data of introspection. Consciousness is the faculty of awareness, the faculty of perceiving that which exists. Awareness is not a passive state, but an active process. Two fundamental attributes are involved in every state, aspect, or function of man's consciousness: content and action. The content of awareness and the action of consciousness in regard to that content. For instance, when you see a woman, the action of your consciousness is perception. When you observe that she is beautiful, the action of your consciousness is evaluation. When you experience pleasure or approval, the action is emotion. When you draw conclusions about a character, the action is thought, etc. To form concepts of consciousness, one isolates the actual content of a given state of consciousness by a process of abstraction, then integrates it with similar actions experienced on different occasions and different contents. In regard to concepts of consciousness, one must always remember that there is no such thing as a thought or a feeling that exists by itself, independent of the living being who experiences it. There is no such thing as a thought or a feeling without content. The most complex category of concepts represent integrations of existential concepts with concepts of consciousness, and designates combinations of physical and psychological actions, as for instance, marriage, property, justice, law, etc. Close quote. For a more detailed treatment of this subject, I again remind you to read Miss Rand's monograph, Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. Okay, now, to continue our discussion, let us turn briefly to the role of language. It is by means of language that man retains and designates his concepts. Language, to quote Miss Rand's definition, is a code of visual auditory symbols that converts abstractions, that is, concepts, into the mental equivalent of concretes. Language substitutes one symbol, one word, for the enormous sum under a concept. Remember that every word we use, with the exception of proper names, stands for an unlimited number of concretes of a certain kind. Words enable man's mind to deal with such broad, complex phenomena, such as matter, energy, freedom, morality, which no mind could grasp or hold if it had to visualize all the perceptual concretes represented by such concepts. Concepts and language primarily are tools of cognition, not of communication, as many people assume. Communication is a consequence, not the primary purpose of concept formation. The primary purpose of concepts and of language is to provide man with a system of cognition, of classification and organization, which enables him to acquire knowledge on an unlimited scale. This means to keep order in man's mind and enable him to think. However, to fulfill this function, language must be exact. Otherwise, neither thought nor communication is possible. Thought can be no more precise than the precision of the tools it employs. When a man thinks, writes, or speaks, he must know clearly and specifically what his words denote. He must know that the meaning of words is not to be switched from moment to moment at his arbitrary wish or whim. He must know that if a jailer decides to call the process of torture re-education, this will not transform a concentration camp into a university. He must know that words are to be used objectively, that words stand for concepts, and that concepts refer to facts of reality. Now, a child does not start from scratch in discovering the process of concept formation. He starts by learning from his elders, by being taught to speak. But even though a child does not have to perform the feat of inventing language, his mind has to perform independently the feat of grasping the nature of language, the process of symbolizing concepts by means of words. Even though a child does not and need not originate and form every concept on his own by observing every aspect of reality confronting him, his mind has to perform the process of differentiating and integrating perceptual concretes in order to grasp the meaning of words. If a child's brain is physically damaged such that he cannot perform this process, he does not learn to speak. Learning to speak does not consist merely of memorizing sounds. Learning to speak consists of grasping meanings, of grasping the reference of words, the kind of things that words denote in reality. When the child learns to speak, he acquires the tools of thought. He rises from the perceptual to the conceptual level of thought, from mere perceiving to thinking. Thinking is not an automatic process. It requires an act of volition, an act of choice. a special mental focus and effort. A child is free to think or to evade. He can seek to understand, or he can substitute imitation for understanding. He can organize and expand and keep on expanding his knowledge, or he can stagnate in a half-conscious stupor by confining himself to whatever half-grasped concretes and undefined words he has learned from others. I will have much to say on the subject of the choice to think or not to think in a subsequent lecture. What I want to stress, and stress again, and stress again, is that the base of all of man's concepts, of all of that tremendous cognitive hierarchy which he builds, is the perceptual level of awareness, which is the start of man's knowledge, which is the given, the self-evident. All concepts are derived from the perception of concrete specific objects. Concepts or abstractions as such do not exist. They are, as Miss Rand makes clear in her monograph, they are man's method of classifying that which exists, and everything that exists is a concrete. To be valid, a concept must be connected with and reducible to its base in perceptual reality. Now, on the higher level of abstraction, that connection consists of a long chain of concepts formed from earlier concepts, formed from still earlier concepts, and so on. In order to be grasped or used, every concept in that chain requires a precise definition. It is only by means of precise definitions that a higher level concept can be reduced or brought back or connected with its base in perceptual reality. In a subsequent lecture given by Barbara Brandon, there will be a discussion of some of the rules involved in correct definition. The subject is also taken up in considerable detail by Miss Rand in her monograph. In that monograph, I might mention, Miss Rand provides a more technical definition of the meaning of a concept than I am providing here. She defines a concept as, quote, "A concept is a mental integration of two or more units possessing the same distinguishing characteristic with their particular measurements omitted," unquote. As I have already indicated, I am not here exploring the full meaning of this analysis of concept formation, because it is too technical for this level of discussion. But for philosophy majors and those who desire a more advanced philosophical analysis of the problem, again, I refer you to Miss Rand's monograph. Concepts are the means to an unlimited expansion of the range of man's consciousness. Animals are bound by the perceptual concretes that confront them at any immediate moment. The range of their awareness is as wide as the reach of their senses, and no wider. But man, sitting at a desk, can chart on the back of an envelope the motion of planets through the outer reaches of space. Such, in briefest possible essentials, is the function of man's reason, and such is the meaning of the objectivist definition of reason as the faculty that identifies and integrates the material provided by man's senses. Now I want briefly to discuss an important principle pertaining to the proper use of concepts, a principle which men fail to grasp with disastrous consequences. Observe that man's knowledge has a hierarchical structure. A higher concept is derived from earlier concepts which serve as its genetic roots. For example, the concept orphan is derived from and presupposes the concept parent. If you had not grasped the concept parent, you could not form the concept orphan. The concept motion presupposes the concept entity, or that which moves. The concept change presupposes the concept identity. If you had not grasped the fact of identity, you could not grasp or form the concept change. And this leads us to a very important principle. When one uses concepts, one must recognize their genetic roots. One must recognize that which they logically depend on and imply. Failure to observe this principle is what we call the fallacy of the stolen concept. This fallacy consists of using a concept while ignoring, contradicting, or denying the validity of the concepts on which it logically and genetically depends. This fallacy is rampant in modern philosophy. all the devices used by mystics and neo-mystics to convince man that the mind is impotent entail one version or another of the fallacy of the stolen concept. Let me illustrate a little of what I mean as follows. It is rational to ask, how does man achieve knowledge? But it is not rational to ask, can man achieve knowledge? Because the ability to ask that question presupposes a knowledge of man and of the nature of knowledge. It is rational to ask what exists. It is not rational to ask, does anything exist? Because the first thing one would have to evade is the existence of the question and of the being who is there to ask it. It is rational to ask, how do the senses enable man to perceive reality? It is not rational to ask, do the senses enable man to perceive reality? Because if they do not, by what means did the speaker acquire his knowledge of the senses of perception of man and of reality? Several years ago, I wrote an article for the Objectivist newsletter which deals with the issue of the stolen concept in more detail. It's in the January 63 issue of the newsletter, which is still available from the Objectivist, and I think you would find it worthwhile reading for a more fully elaborated discussion of this fallacy. Now let us proceed further. The enemies of reason attack man's consciousness from two sides. They attack the tools of man's knowledge, his concepts, and they also attack the source of man's knowledge, his senses. It is the validity of sensory evidence that all mystics and neo-mystics have invariably challenged in order to seek to undercut the validity of man's mind. I will have more to say about that argument next week. But I want to say here that all the doubts, confusions, and misconceptions about man's consciousness rest in large measure on a misunderstanding of the role played by the senses in the process of acquiring knowledge. The senses do not give us knowledge, they give us only the material of knowledge. Quoting from Atlas Shrugged, the task of man's senses is to give him the evidence of existence. But the task of identifying it belongs to his reason. His senses tell him only that something is, but what it is must be learned by his mind. For example, you have all heard the argument that the senses deceive us or are unreliable because a stick is straight when it is seen out of water but looks bent when it is seen in water. The conclusion drawn from this is that our eyes are not a reliable guide to reality. This argument is an example of the fallacy of the stolen concept in that it uses sensory evidence in order to demonstrate the invalidity of sensory evidence. Further, however, the argument is a total misrepresentation of the role played by man's senses. The senses do not provide out-of-context evidence of reality. They provide the total of that which is sensorially perceivable. The explanation of the phenomenon of the stick in water is as follows. Light waves travel more slowly through water than they travel through air. Consequently, the part of the stick which is submerged in water appears at an angle to the part of the stick which is above water. Our eyes, in this case, are being damned because they provide us with the full context, the comprehensive evidence of everything within their range of perception. They give us not only the sensory evidence of the stick's shape, but also the evidence of the motion and the different speeds of light through two different media. They give us the evidence, not the explanation. It is the task of man's mind to observe the phenomenon, to identify all its factors, and to explain it. Man's knowledge is not gained automatically. Concepts are not formed automatically. Identifications and explanations of this kind can be reached only on the conceptual level of consciousness. Man's mind is not infallible. His thinking is open to the possibility of errors. But man's senses cannot deceive him. They cannot distort the evidence. They cannot act willfully or causelessly. Senses are physical organs and as such are inexorably subject to causal necessity, determined by the nature of the organ and of the stimulus. The message transmitted to the brain obeys an absolute rule of physical causal necessity. It is the task of man's mind to identify and to interpret that message. When errors occur, they are errors of interpretation and are made by the mind, by the reader of the message, not by the messengers. Now, you might want to ask, but what if one's eyesight begins to fail? Doesn't it then give a distorted picture of reality? No, it does not. It merely gives you a less efficient, more limited picture, the exact picture it is capable of giving in its weakened physical state. It is then the task of your mind to observe that your eyesight is now less efficient, to discover the cause of it, and to acquire a pair of glasses. A very important epistemological error is the failure to differentiate between the perception of reality and the form in which reality is perceived. Many philosophers claim that man's perception of reality is not valid because it is influenced or determined by the nature of the sense organs. Their argument goes as follows. When you perceive reality, you perceive it by means of physical sense organs. Therefore, what your mind gets is only an interaction between something which you can never see and the particular nature of your sense organs. If a man came from Mars with different sense organs, he would perceive a totally different reality. Now, what our senses do affect is the form in which we perceive reality, not the objectivity of our perception. For instance, when we touch a hot object, we receive a sensation of heat. Heat is caused by the movement of the molecules which compose the object. The slower the molecular motion, the colder the object. The faster the molecular motion, the hotter the object. If instead of the sense of heat, I had a sense which allowed me to feel the molecular motion of an object under my fingertips, and when I touched that object, I felt motion instead of heat, I would be perceiving the same reality, the same fact of reality that I had perceived before, but I would be perceiving it in a different form. And it would still be the task of my mind to interpret my sensations, to interpret and to learn the same fact, but now by means of different data. Man has various senses which give him different forms of perceiving reality. And if I were to ask you at dinner, what is the real truth about this roast beef that I am serving you? Is it brown or is it hot? Well, you would say correctly that my question is absurd. Two different sense organs are making you aware of two different attributes of the roast beef. One, the speed of the molecular motion in the roast beef. The other, the manner in which the roast beef absorbs light rays. You are not perceiving two different realities. You are perceiving two different aspects of the same reality. Suppose that a Martian came down to Earth and that he had sense organs totally different from ours. Suppose that instead of eyesight, he was able to feel the vibration of light waves bouncing off objects, to feel it as a physical pressure on his cheeks. Why, then he would be perceiving reality in a different form that we do, but he would be perceiving the same reality. That which we have to infer or deduce, he would perceive directly. But having sense organs different from ours, he would have to deduce that which we perceive directly. Certainly reality, the object of perception, would remain the same. Men, animals, and insects have different forms of perceiving reality and different ranges of awareness. But they do not perceive three different realities. They perceive the same reality in three different forms. Now consider the case of a colorblind man. He perceives reality as correctly as we do. Only there are certain differences in his form of perception, and certain discriminations which he cannot make as sharply as we can. While we experience the sensations of red and green, he experiences two shades of color resembling brown, which are not as sharply differentiated as red and green. But he is reacting to the same vibrations of the same light rays. Only, since the structure of his organ of sight is slightly different from ours, his form of perceiving the same vibrations, the same facts, differs slightly from ours. Man's knowledge, full scientific knowledge, is conceptual, not sensory. Sensations and percepts are the material, the bricks out of which man builds the structure of his knowledge. Man's mind is blank at birth, in that he has no innate ideas. An idea is an identification of some aspect of reality. Man can have no knowledge of reality ahead of any contact with reality. What he has is only the capacity to acquire knowledge, the organs which will make knowledge possible. It was Aristotle who identified the fact that man's mind was blank at birth. In philosophy, this view of man's consciousness is symbolized by the famous expression tabula rasa, which means blank wax tablet. The mind is a blank tablet at birth, and the senses are the means by which man proceeds to write upon that blank tablet, to fill it with percepts, with concepts, with knowledge. The hatred of mystics and neo-mystics for man's mind is motivated by the rebellion against the fact that man's mind is tabula rasa at birth, in a word, that all of man's knowledge has to be acquired, that the responsibility of acquiring knowledge is man's, that knowledge is not granted to him automatically by revelation, without choice or effort on his part. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the tragedy of mankind is not that men are born tabula rasa, but that too many of them die tabula rasa, more or less.